Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. This is part two of a two-part episode. We talked with Adam Hochschild earlier, his book, Bury the Chains, about the freeing of the slaves, the abolition movement, the ending of the slave trade. Absolutely must-read core idea in this Stoic principle of justice. Well, most people don't know that Adam wrote a very brilliant memoir, one I enjoyed quite a bit, called Half the Way Home, A Memoir of Father and Son. And when I read it, I almost broke down in tears. It was just an absolutely beautiful book. It reminded me of this great essay that Kafka wrote called Letter to the Father. It's about basically a young son struggling with a sort of an overbearing, stern, distant father and reckoning with this. They're trying to get closer, speaking very different languages, having very different experiences. It's not an abusive relationship by any means, but there is something, some gap that they struggle to close. And it's a haunting, moving memoir. I absolutely loved it. So when I read that, that's when I reached out to Adam and asked if he'd want to come on the podcast and talk about both those two books. And that's when he let me know that he had a third book that had just come out. And he asked if I would like to read that and talk to him about that book. And I said, are you kidding? Absolutely. That new book is called American Midnight, The Great War, A Violent Peace, in Democracy's Forgotten Crisis, about World War I, about this period of the Woodrow Wilson presidency. America is on the brink. It feels like the social fabric is falling apart. There's violence in the streets. There's a reactionary anti-immigrant movement, an anti-immigrant movement, and a race movement. there's conflict in every conceivable way. Adam says it's our Trumpiest period, aside from the one that we're currently in. I think that's right. So I talked about that new book with him and his classic memoir, which I cannot recommend enough, and I'm going to start carrying the painted porch. Half the Way Home, A Memoir of Father and Son. This is the second part of our in-depth conversation. I really enjoyed talking to him. I could have talked to him for another hour or more. I'm going to read more of his stuff and hopefully have him on the podcast again, but I'll just let you get right to the episode now. This was a great conversation. Thank you, Adam. And check out his books, and I'll talk to y'all soon. Just thinking about my issues with my own parents, I was also struck by when you grow up and you realize that your parents were married to each other and they had a relationship and a dynamic as two people who met and brought a person into the world, right? You tend to think of your parents as these special people when really they're just two people who met on the street who were totally unqualified to do this thing that is having kids, as we all are, right? Yeah. And you're this sort of dynamic where your mother was so in love with and relentlessly supportive of your father and probably totally ignorant of the strain or pain that his worldview or approach had on you, not realizing even that she was sort of tacitly endorsing all of it. I found that to be very interesting in the book.
Yeah, I think that's a not unfamiliar pattern, because I've certainly run into many people who said there was something similar in their own lives. My mother, who was not a career woman, didn't have a job really, was extremely loving, and I felt loved me unconditionally. Yeah. And that's a wonderful feeling for a kid to have. She loved my father unconditionally too. So when she sensed that there was some tension between us, or that I seemed to be a little fearful of him, and I think it's impossible that she would not sense that, she tried to better it just by telling me what a wonderful man he was, which, yes, of course, didn't help that much, because that made me feel all the more guilty for feeling fearful, sure, or apprehensive around him.
Yes.
So again, she had very good intentions, but I don't think it was quite the right way to go about it.
Well, I think one of the cautionary tales of the book is, and perhaps this is somewhat addressed by, you know, the changing of gender roles and the equalization of things, or the closer to equalization of things. But it struck me as a reminder to all parents of the power that you have over your children implicitly, intrinsically by nature of who you are, and needing to be quite sensitive to the effect that that power has over a child. So what you think is a sarcastic remark or a rolling of the eyes or a bit of feedback or whatever, you know, lands so heavily on a 9-year-old or a 6-year-old or a 17-year-old who is trying to figure out who they are in this world, that a sort of a sensitivity to, and not just sensitivity, but a profound empathy for the person on the other side of these things, that they are so much smaller and less secure and less confident than you are, and needing to be cognizant of that. This struck me as a takeaway from the book.
Yeah. I think, we often forget as parents that when we speak to children, especially small children, we're speaking through a loudspeaker that, yeah, kind of magnifies the effect of our words, and that any kind of criticism or disapproval is often felt much more heavily than it was intended.
Well, especially as a child, as they get older and they seek an unconventional path in life, which you talk about, like, it's already so scary to decide to be a writer or a creative or to not go into a safe, dependable profession. And so, you know, parents think, oh, well, I just want you to think about this concern or that concern, or I'm just looking out for you, I'm just worried about you. But you don't realize how how shaky the foundation the person is on as they are deciding to do this or that thing. I dropped out of college when I was 19, and I think my parents were quite worried I would, end up under a bridge somewhere, which I, as I get older and now a parent myself, I relate to. But I also, if I could go back and I'd say, I was also worried about ending up under a bridge somewhere. I didn't need anyone to tell me how dangerous what I was doing was. I needed someone to tell me that, if it did go to shit, I wouldn't end up under a bridge somewhere, right? Yeah. You need what you need is support, not someone shouting out, be careful, you're going to hurt yourself.
Yeah. Also, I think my father was, he grew up and thrived in a world of business executives, senators, governors, influential people, foundation presidents, influential people politically. This was the world he knew. This was the world he imagined a place for me in it. Mm-hmm. And when I took a different path, it was really upsetting to him. But at the same time, he and my mother both sort of were ideologically liberals and, read all the proper child-rearing books that said you should, let your child discover his talent and do whatever he is most talented at. And this came into conflict with the son that my father had always imagined. And in a sense, I think the son my mother had imagined it too. So when I would say, I really do like writing and I feel that's what I'm good at, my father would say, well, yes, but I think you'd be really much more talented in running an organization or something like that.
Well, in a sense, this is where your two books are connected, in that you sort of detail in the book this awakening that, you have. You sort of grow up, your father's, relatively progressive and open-minded, and certainly not some, reactionary, sort of entrenched elitist, but you had this sort of slow realization that the world you grew up in was not normal and not particularly fair or just, and that there were, assumptions that people had made that were not predicated on, maybe the values that you purported to have. And you sort of went around and traveled and saw some of these places that as a child you'd taken for granted, but then as an adult you realized, hey, this zinc mine in Africa is, inherently exploitative or racist or these number of things. You ended up questioning the paradigm that you grew up in, which, as we were talking about, is one of the hardest things for people to do.
Yeah, I think in a way I benefited from, in a way, growing up in a setting that really showed me something about how the world economy worked. Mm. I grew up in the United States. I had a very comfortable life. My parents were able to afford to send me to college. We had a very comfortable estate we lived on in the summertime in the Adirondack Mountains in upstate New York. And then my father at one point made what may have been the mistake of taking me with him on a business trip to Africa, where he visited the copper mines that the company he worked for owned shares in. And I began to realize that all of these lovely things I'd enjoyed all my life, the motorboats on the lake, the college education, everything else, were paid for by the labor of African copper miners working far under the earth in very hot, damp, often dangerous conditions, and just being paid a few shillings a day for it. And that showed me something about how the world worked. It gave me a lens through which to look at this extremely unequal world that we live in. And I think that, combined with the fact that I came of age politically in the 1960s, when the civil rights movement was undergoing a huge revival. I became a part of it. My then girlfriend, now wife, and I were briefly civil rights workers in Mississippi in 1964. I got very drawn into the movement against the Vietnam War. When I finally, under the Freedom of Information Act, managed to get my FBI files and CIA files, I found there were more than 100 pages of surveillance reports on me, some of which included mention of my father, because he actually also was opposed to the war. So ironically, in this big issue that most divided people from their parents in the 1960s and 1970s, the war in Vietnam, we were on the same side.
Yeah, I was writing about this where there's this moment after Theodore Roosevelt is elected to the state legislature in New York. He's asked to vote on this cigar maker's bill. And it's the first time in his life that he heads just a couple blocks south and visits these tenements that the cigar makers are living in. And it's his, although he'd had a, you know, again, a relatively liberal, open-minded, charitable family, he still lived in this cocoon of privilege and convenience. And he is forced to look at how the other half lives. And once he sees it, I think, as all of us are forced to do, we have a choice. Do we turn away from it and pretend it doesn't exist? Or do we decide to dedicate ourselves either completely or partially to doing something about it?
Yeah. So I was grateful to be exposed to all those things growing up. And, you know, I have a lot to be grateful for in terms of the scope of my early life. Difficult as it may have been to resolve them all, and it took me a long time to do it, I certainly got to see a great deal of the world, and a great deal of the world that was beyond the little slice of it that I'd spent most of my time in.
So talk to me about Freedom Summer. That must have been an incredible experience.
It was. This was the summer of 1964, when the civil rights movement has revived in a big way for the preceding couple of years. Freedom riders getting on buses, going through the South, walking in groups of young white and black people together to eat at bus station cafeterias, often getting beaten up by local thugs and vigilantes, arrested. Finally, the principal organizer, a man named Robert Moses, who died recently, a remarkable human being, had the inspiration, feeling that the country was not going to take the civil rights movement seriously until white people, as well as black, were taken to the South and saw the indignities that black Americans have to go through every day. So they recruited 1,000 young people, almost all white, almost all from the North, to spend the summer in Mississippi. A number of them got beaten up. Three people were killed, two white guys from New York and a local Mississippi guy that they were working with, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney. And it sort of focused the attention of the country on this state that was picked because it was the most reactionary in terms of segregation rights for black people and so on. Nothing happened to me. I was very lucky. I was just there a few weeks. But some weeks after we left, the house where I and the other volunteers had lived was actually blown up by a dynamite bomb. Luckily, no one was hurt, but it was a reminder that the people, the carloads of young white kids who used to drive by the house shouting slurs at night, had returned with something more powerful than just words.
Well, as we go back and try to understand those 12 people in that print shop who got outraged and stayed outraged about other people's rights, in a sense, that's what Freedom Summer was about. I mean, it makes sense why Bob Moses was motivated to deal with those things, right? But why 1,000 white kids from the North would be willing to put themselves in that kind of danger it goes to that fundamentally beautiful thing that we are sometimes capable of, where we care about other people's rights.
That's right. And we have to do that on a worldwide scale right now. We have to do it as we wrestle with the problem of global warming, as we wrestle with the problem of autocrats all over the world doing horrible things. I'm moved and pleased when I drive through various communities in the United States right now and see all the Ukrainian flags out.
Yeah.
That's showing we have the ability to empathize with other people who are suffering something quite terrible right now. I wish there was a flag that we could display that showed our compassion and outrage at the fact that a third of Pakistan is underwater because of floods caused by global warming.
What about a million people who died, most of them needlessly, of a virus, you know, over the last 3 years? That's right. Our inability to get, it's like our greatest moments are when we get outraged on behalf of other people's rights. And some of our most shameful moments, whether we're looking at, you know, the response to COVID, or you're looking at, you know, that it took 30 odd years or 40 odd years to pass for the Senate to ratify the UN Treaty Against Genocide.
Yeah.
Our most shameful moments are when we see something and we say, that doesn't affect me.
Yeah. And there is a deep, deep streak of that doesn't affect me in American life. We're here. We've got oceans on either side of us. The rest of the world doesn't really touch us. Let's keep it that way. But of course, we are part of a larger world in many, many ways. We're united by the climate we live in, by the practices that we do. We are connected with everyone else, and we can never forget that.
It strikes me that your father's generation, or not even generation, but your father, the archetype of your father, is increasingly a bygone figure, in that the wealthier one seems to be, the more privileged one seems to be, the more ensconced one seems to be in power or society or status or class, it almost goes with an increased indifference to what those other, like when I look at the political movement of our time, I see almost a reactionary rejection of even the impulse to care about other people. We call it virtue. Like, we even have a derisive term for it. We call it virtue signaling, to care about other people, or to express care about other people's rights or principles or ideals.
Well, I'm all for signaling virtue.
Of course.
And for acting on it.
Yes, they're not exclusive, but you can't have one without the other.
That's true. Yeah.
But it strikes me as sort of sad, and I see this in my father and many of his peers. Obviously, my father's probably about your age, maybe a little younger. But I struggle with what feels like a betrayal of the values that they taught me as a kid, all the things that they told me were important about America, right? So to grow up, you know, my father telling me what's great about America is immigrants, you know, what's great about America is the way that we've struggled to address things like civil rights and segregation, you know, what all the values of what conservatism once embraced, and obviously there were problems with it, but once embraced, compared to what it stands for now, or the things it's willing to accept now in order to achieve political power. I think a lot of people my age, we saw this politically, we saw it during the pandemic, but there is this kind of almost a betrayal of the things that our parents told us were important.
Yes, certainly. And we see it very clearly, you know, when it comes to elections, you know, when there are people, you know, denying that the results of elections and so on. What's more basic than that?
Mm-hmm. Your father did seem consistent in the sense, and you, probably a great gift that you didn't have this big conflict over Vietnam, the way that I imagine many of his peers had with their children. Yeah. But yeah, I have struggled to figure out how to reconcile, you know, the person that I thought my parents were, and then who they become as they've gotten older.
Well, you're not alone, Ryan. There are people all over the country who I think are wrestling with similar things. And what makes it all the more painful is sometimes the people who believe the most outrageous things, you know, that George Soros is pulling strings that connect to ballot boxes in Pennsylvania and all kinds of crazy stuff like that. Sometimes people believe the most outrageous things can be kind and warm and generous in their personal lives.
Yes.
And, you know, they're hard things to put together. But that's true. I've learned a lot traveling with my wife, Arlie, who has for the last 10 years studied Trump voters or earlier on people who later became Trump voters in Louisiana, now in Eastern Kentucky. And, you know, I've met some of these folks. They visited us. We visited them. They're people who have hearts of gold, but yes, who believe all kinds of things that I think are complete nonsense about the state of the world and the workings of American democracy.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit, FIT/dailystoic, and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Well, I live in rural Texas, and I experience that where the person who would, I think about, I have this neighbor, we live on this dirt road, and there's no homeowners association. It's a collective community of neighbors who have to take care of this road if it is drivable. And I watch, you know, one of my neighbors who, every time it rains, is out there taking care of the road. He's not getting any money for it. He does collect money from the other neighbors, for which he is a perfect steward. And then I also drive by, you know, the Let's Go Brandon flag that he has from the flagpole. Mm-hmm. And you go, how do you reconcile these two things?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it is so vexing. To watch someone get sucked into something that is so contrary to their values.
Yeah. And we have to honor the decent sides of these people at the same time as we're appalled by the, you know, the things they believe politically. And at the same time, and this is the hard part, when we find it almost impossible to talk about those political disagreements.
Right.
Because if somebody is really convinced that, you know, that COVID shot you have is Bill Gates implanting a microchip in your arm or something that's going to send signals, or is really convinced, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, that their satellite rays, some kind of Jewish conspiracy of satellite rays that are affecting voting systems. You can't talk somebody out of that stuff. Yeah. You still have to relate to them as a human being, but those things are not subject to rational argument.
Well, your wife wrote Strangers in Their Own Land, right?
That's right. That's right.
And I think the premise of it, it is at least intellectually helpful to understand that it's coming from a place of fear and instability and vulnerability, as opposed to somewhere else. As I think the great civil rights leaders wanted us to understand that the Southerners who were acting so abominably were doing so from a similar place of fear and uncertainty and what happens when your world feels like it's changing beneath your feet. That doesn't make it right, but you can understand it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think understanding, you have to have that understanding and let it at least partially enable you to talk to people, partially build a relationship on the human qualities that you can agree on. And then maybe there's some hope that they will take a little more seriously the things that you believe. Or maybe there isn't. But we still, you know, this guy with the Let's Go Brandon flag is still your neighbor. And you still have to relate to him as your neighbor. And to find some basis of communication there, even admitting that there are other things that you'll never agree on.
Yeah, it's certainly challenging, I think, as you wrestle with the understanding, and I think this is maybe what America is going through as a whole, and you talk about in the book, though, which is realizing that your childhood or your history was not quite so idyllic as you thought, or it wasn't fully as clean as you thought it was. And there is a pain. Some people can face that and come to terms with it and be made better for it. And other people have to retreat further into the illusions that were so comforting when they were young.
Yes. Yes. That's true. Yeah. Well, you must have quite a few neighbors that you have these kinds of sense of differences with.
I do. It's a reminder, though. It's helpful, at least, not to live in a bubble where I don't know this is even
absolutely
happening.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Because most of us do live in bubbles of one sort or another.
Yes.
Yeah. Are you from rural Texas originally, or
no? I'm from Northern California.
Ah, all the more bravo for moving to rural Texas.
Well, you know, it's this struggle too. I think a lot of people that have moved to these different cities over the last 5 or 10 years in my generation, as they've, you know, sought cheaper housing or different opportunities or whatever, is this sense that, oh, this place isn't maybe fully what I thought it was. Maybe there's a darkness to this idyllic little place that I'm in. And then you're faced with the question of, do I leave and go back to a bubble where everyone thinks and acts like me? Mm-hmm. Or do you stay and try to be the values that you think that place should have more of?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, bravo to you for staying there.
Well, thank you. And I know we've been at this a while, so I want to switch to the new book, which I found fascinating, American Midnight. I read a quote a few years ago about George Washington, which is basically, the more you study George Washington, the more you admire him, right? Mm-hmm. So it doesn't totally hold up, because you see the ads that he put out to capture his escaped slaves, and you know, you think a little bit less of him. But generally, it's true. The more you learn about Washington, the more you admire him. I have found the exact opposite is true with Woodrow Wilson.
Mm-hmm. That was certainly my case too. Wilson was a very complicated and interesting and paradoxical man. Not somebody that I loathe or hate. It's hard to have that feeling about him. But I'm fascinated by his contradictions.
Yeah.
He was a great idealist in many ways. He was the last president of the Progressive Era when it came to the graduated income tax, child labor laws, regulating business, and so forth. He was all for that. And then his great idealistic project was the League of Nations, where the countries of the world would gather around a table and talk out their differences instead of going to war. And the United States would be sort of the leading force there, and war would be forever gone from the face of the earth. In fact, I don't think it would have worked that way any more than the UN has been able to stop war since it was formed in 1945. But, you know, nobody can dispute that it's better for countries to talk than to fight. And Wilson's dedication to that cause shortened his life, because he embarked on a speaking tour promoting the League when he was in ill health. And a month into it, he suffered the first of several near-fatal strokes that shortened his life. At the same time as all this, this very idealistic man, well-spoken, author of a dozen books, former college president, college professor most of his life, presided over the greatest assault on civil liberties in 20th century American history, and showed no concern about it. Under his rule, and this is a part of our history that, at least in my high school American history textbook, we never learned much of anything about. There was a period of 4 years, 1917 through early 1921, where we had press censorship on a huge scale in this country. We had vigilante violence that was actually encouraged and sponsored by the Justice Department. We had political imprisonment during those 4 years. Roughly 1,000 Americans were sent to jail for a year or more, and a much larger number for shorter periods, solely for things that they wrote or said. And all this was under Wilson's watch. So that's the period that I wanted to try to bring alive in American Midnight.
Well, it's interesting. We tend to think of history as this sort of, some of the injustices of history as being these things that were just not questioned. For instance, let's say segregation or racism or Jim Crow. But that's, you know, not actually what the Wilson presidency was. The Wilson presidency was in some ways the restoration of those injustices. Do you know what I mean? Like Wilson wasn't just this guy that woke up in a world and he didn't question it. That's sort of one form of injustice. What I think so appalling and forces you to reckon with Wilson in a different way was his establishment of some of those ideas proactively, right? Like to go back to the 1780s, you have, you know, Clarkson and these others fighting for the elimination of slavery. And we forget that Napoleon, for instance, reintroduces slavery the French Empire.
Right.
And that a single individual can make such a negative difference too.
Yeah. Wilson was the first Southerner elected president since the Civil War. He had been governor of New Jersey, but he'd been born in Virginia, grown up there and in Georgia. And he was very much a white Southerner in his way of thinking. And in his two terms in power, he rolled back the amount of Black employment in the federal government. He resegregated departments where there had been a certain amount of desegregation. As a historian, he took a startlingly benign view of slavery. And when the worst racial violence in the 20th century killed something approaching 1,000 Americans, we'll never know the exact number, in the summer of 1919, he said virtually nothing about it. So this was also something that made that a very dark period in American life.
He was complicit and guilty in the lost cause mythology, and then the sort of white supremacy that the vestiges of which are still with us today. You know, he is so largely responsible for their resurgence in the 20th century, in the period you talk about in the book. It's not just the war and labor that are battling for their, you know, battling it out in the literal battlefield and the battle of ideas, but this idea of sort of white supremacy in a caste society in America, you know, that's being fought for in this moment also.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, it would have been hard for a president, a much better president, to make huge progress on civil rights in that era. But Wilson certainly rolled things backward in that respect. There's no doubt about it.
Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
Yes. Yeah. Theodore Roosevelt wasn't perfect and had so many of his own racist problematic ideas, but seemed to be at least on the same page about, you know, what the values and principles of America were supposed to be, even if he didn't always live up to them.
Yeah.
So when you look at this period of when I study history, I am often have one of two reactions. One, I realize how bad the past was, and I get very nervous about where things are and where they're going. Mm-hmm. The other is I look at how terrible the past was, and I go, oh yeah, it's always been this way. I can when I have a larger, more expansive view, I'm able to contextualize things better and realize not just that progress is possible, like with someone like Clarkson and some of the movements we're talking about, but also that when we idealize the past, we do the present an injustice because we're assuming that it's somehow worse than it was before. We're not really aware. Like, you just look at the year 1968, you look at the unrest, you look at the violence, you look at the injustice, you look at the fact they were also dealing with an influenza epidemic that killed 200,000 people, and you go, oh, I understand 2020 and 2021 a little bit better now. We're doing okay, right? Mm-hmm. When you look at this particular period in American history that you're writing about in American Midnight, how does it help you contextualize the present?
Well, I was drawn to this period because it seemed to me the Trumpiest period in American life before Trump.
Yeah.
Vigilante violence on a huge scale. And as I mentioned, you know, the largest of these vigilante groups, something called the American Protective League, was chartered by the Justice Department. They went around beating up anti-war demonstrators, you know, doing citizens' arrests by the tens of thousands of young men who might be avoiding the draft, and so on. Also, under new names, after this group was dissolved, the same people, you know, took part as strikebreakers in assaulting steel workers and other workers who were on strike. So there was this vigilante violence. There were things that Trump would have liked to have done.
Yes.
Like putting large numbers of people in prison, people who criticized him, but wasn't able to. You know, in 2016, his followers chanted about Hillary Clinton, lock her up, lock her up, lock her up. Well, they didn't lock her up, but Woodrow Wilson actually did lock up one of his opponents, Eugene Debs, the socialist candidate for president, who won 6% of the popular vote in 1912. And he locked up close to 1,000 people, other people as well. Trump would have liked to have censored the media in a huge way. He wasn't able to, but Woodrow Wilson and his administration did. Press censorship was authorized by Congress, which gave the Postmaster General the ability to declare a publication unmailable through the U.S. mail. And this was at a time when anything other than a daily newspaper, that is, a weekly, a monthly, a journal of opinion, most of the foreign language press, they depended on the mail to reach their subscribers. But 400 specific issues of newspapers and magazines were banned. Some 75 were forced out of business entirely. So I look at this period of repression and I think, should we worry that something the same or worse is coming down the pike now? Or should we feel relieved that it came to an end, which means that we can get out of the pickle that we seem to be in Yes. right now? And I feel a little of both. I do worry that if the elections now and in 2024 put in power people who challenge the results of elections themselves, there is no limit to what they will do about censorship or anything else. There's no limit. If you, the moment you sort of question the actual workings of democracy and send thugs in to disrupt the counting of votes, things like that, there's no limit.
But it's interesting, right? Because we, for instance, one of the concerns now is the sort of collapse of the rule of law, right? That we're making a mockery of the legal system. But then you read about some of the things you're talking about in the book and you go, rule of law, what a pleasant fiction, right? Or yeah. Your point about the questioning of elections. Yeah, sure, it's very problematic after a free and fair election when one does not like the results to question it and try to overturn it. But, you know, up until the summer that you were in the South, there just weren't free and fair elections in half the United States.
That's right.
They weren't trying to overturn them afterwards because they'd fixed them before they could happen.
Yeah, and Black people could not vote in the South. That's true.
So I sometimes think about, you know, how much of what we are worried about happening today, if 1/10 of what happened in the past was happening today, we'd lose our minds.
Yeah, that's true. But I still think we shouldn't let our guard down.
Agreed.
Because there are a lot of terrible things that could happen in the next. Back at the period I wrote about in American Midnight, this period roughly 100 years ago, I do think there's some aspects of it that are not likely to happen again. I think that for all of us, there is a greater respect for the Bill of Rights today than there was 100 years ago in this country. Actually, one of the organizations that's helped forge that, the American Civil Liberties Union, actually came into being at an earlier period under a different name as an organization supporting conscientious objectors. And I think they've helped establish, a greater appreciation of civil liberties, the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment today than existed a century ago. I also think that, again, for all its faults and some appalling recent decisions, the Supreme Court, over the course of the 20th and early 21st century, made a number of enlightened decisions, which they wouldn't have made 100 years ago, and didn't make 100 years ago, when, for instance, there was a decision, a unanimous decision, upholding the Espionage Act, with its giving the right to the government to censor the press and to silence people and send them to prison for saying what they believed. So I think we've got some improvements in our national consciousness, but I do think we still do face some dangers.
Yeah, the history of the Supreme Court is such an interesting one because of some of those landmark and necessary decisions, we have in some cases an inflated view of the history and nobility of the Supreme Court, when in fact, many of the worst moments in American history began with civil Supreme Court decisions in this era and going back. And I think sometimes understanding that history, it gives you not just an honest picture, but it also gives you a more balanced picture that allows you not to, I just feel like the last couple of years, people have been going around screaming, this isn't normal. This is unprecedented. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's very precedented and very normal. That doesn't mean that it's acceptable in any way, but in the sense that, a special forces operator or a firefighter, they don't run up to a fire and go, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. We have no idea what to do about this, right? They have to be calm under that pressure and see it as a solvable problem if there is any hope of mitigating that damage or solving that problem.
Yeah. I mean, just talking about the Supreme Court, one of the most moving moments that I felt I was able to write about in American Midnight was about a Supreme Court justice who changed his mind about something. And I'm thinking of Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., who in early 1919 wrote the unanimous decision upholding the Espionage Act. It was a case where several people had been sent to jail for circulating a leaflet opposing conscription, opposing the draft. And Holmes wrote for the whole court in declaring that the law that under which they sent to jail was completely constitutional and that free speech was free speech, but this often repeated phrase, that doesn't give somebody the right to shout fire in a crowded theater, which was a ridiculous thing to say because, in fact, opposing conscription is not like shouting fire in a crowded theater.
But, not like that at all.
Some months later, another case came before the court, again involving some people prosecuted under the Espionage Act, again for distributing a leaflet which had been tossed out the window of a garment factory in New York City. And Holmes changed his mind, and he told his colleagues on the court that he was going to write a dissent, not upholding the Espionage Act. They were so alarmed that three of them came to see him at home and said, you have to, we have to stick together on this. You have to be like the old soldier you once were, because Holmes had actually been wounded.
And he'd almost died at Gettysburg.
In the Civil War, right. And they were speaking in his study in the very room where his officer's sword hung on the wall. And we know what they said, because his law clerk was in the next room listening in through a half-open door. And Holmes said, no, I'm going to dissent. And Justice Louis Brandeis joined him in that dissent. Supreme Court dissents don't make law, but the words of their dissent, which have to do with the importance of the free marketplace of ideas has been more quoted than any other Supreme Court dissent in history. And I think from that moment on, the court did become somewhat more enlightened and led to some of the great decisions later on in the 20th century, Brown versus Board of Education, and decisions on gay marriage in our own century. So there is possibility for people to change their mind and to grow. And
well, that's one of the beautiful stories in Barry the Chains, the man who wrote Amazing Grace. You detail his sort of story from being a merchant of slaves effectively into being an anti-slavery advocate and or at least the writer of an anthem that helped lead and inspire that movement.
Yeah, John Newton, who'd been a slave ship captain. You know, people think of his great hymn as being an anthem of abolition, but it really wasn't. He wrote that before he became involved in the anti-slavery movement. But he did change his mind. He was willing to go on record as being in favor of abolition and wrote a very forceful pamphlet against slavery, testified before Parliament. And it's always moving to me when you see somebody who's capable of doing that.
Well, this idea that no one is fully irredeemable is such a beautiful idea. To talk about Supreme Court dissents, one of, I think, the most beautiful and moving ones in American history is Harlan's dissent in Plessy v. Ferguson.
Yes, Harlan.
Not just, you know, insisting on what those amendments were supposed to be about, but it's all the more beautiful when you realize he himself had been a slave owner prior to the Civil War.
Yeah.
And this idea that, to go to your point about coalitions and working with people, no one is fully a lost cause.
Yeah. I'm always looking in history for those people who change sides.
Yes. They're the ones that inspire us that we're not lost causes.
Yeah. Or people who grow to become aware of something that they weren't aware of earlier.
Yes. I'm writing about Truman now, and there's a quote from one of his advisors, and they said the most remarkable thing about Harry Truman in those years that he was president was his capacity to grow and change.
Yeah, because he hadn't been brought into the know about anything, about the Hiroshima bomb or anything else by Roosevelt. So he had to learn fast, and he did.
Well, so as we wrap up, speaking of the Supreme Court, it strikes me that that's probably what your father wanted for you. He wanted you to be one of those kinds of people.
He wouldn't have minded, I'm sure. He was very intent that I go to law school. I don't think he had any friends who were judges, but he sure had a lot of friends who were influential lawyers of one kind or another.
Well, he wanted you to be a part of the establishment, thinking that was the way that you could make a difference, that one, that was how you would be safe and secure and not persecuted or, you know, any of these sort of deep subconscious fears that you talk about in the book. But I also think that's how he thought you would contribute to society, right? Yeah. That's how you would pay forward the privileges and gifts that you had been given. And you have gone on to have such a big impact in the world through your work and your writing, working maybe a little bit more outside the system. Do you feel like your father came around to understand that fully?
That
there are different paths?
Not really, because by the time I had not written any books by the time he died, although I had co-founded a magazine, which was fairly successful, and done a lot of magazine pieces. But I think he might have been pleased with some of the books that I've written. And, you know, in my next life, I'll be a Supreme Court justice.
I'm trying to find a way to end this on a note of hope. So I was hoping you'd say, he saw it all. We came around. He realized that my way also worked, and all was well.
I can't quite say that, but I can certainly say, as I and I tried to go into detail about this at the end of Halfway Home, that we did make our peace. And I'm very grateful that he lived long enough for that to happen. Because I have friends who've struggled with difficult parents. And often the most painful thing is when that parent dies before there's a chance of resolution, because usually there is a chance of some kind of resolution if both people want it.
Do you feel like, I guess, if we're thinking about ultimately what we control, because, you know, our parents are going to do what our parents are going to do, do you feel like you were able to make peace with it, or is it something that you still carry around and is painful?
Oh, I feel I've completely made peace with it. Writing the book was a big help. Writing Half the Way Home was a huge help. But my goodness, if you're as old as I am, four decades now, and haven't made peace, you're in tough shape. So I feel very grateful to be where I am in life, to have people that I love, and to have work that I love doing, and that I hope has at least some small impact in the world.
Well, it's certainly had a big impact on me, and I thank you for writing it, and I'm glad you were able to get there.
Good. Well, thank you very much, Ryan.
It's a total honor. Thanks so much for listening to the Daily Stoic podcast. If you don't know this, you can get these delivered to you via email every day. Check it out at dailystoic.com/email. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Okay, so if you had a time machine, how far in time would you need to go back to be a dominant basketball player of that era?
I need to go to when Bob Cousy was playing.
Back in the plumber
27-year-old
days?
27-year-old Shea would give Bob Cousy the f***ing business. He's not guarding me.
Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the best.
Each week, Shea and I are combing through all of the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling ones, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Six Trophies ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.